Welcome, everybody, to Podcasting Them Softly. I'm Frank, and of course, I'm joined by Nick. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Excited. It should be a lot of fun today.
Absolutely. We are back to a regular episode where Nick and I discuss a film that's either underappreciated, underseen, and/or unfairly shit upon by critics. What makes this episode so special is we're going to be speaking about the 2012 film Rites of Passage. That was written and directed by friend of Podcasting Them Softly, Peter Iliff, who just so happens to be joining us for this episode to talk about his film with us. So, Peter, thank you so very much for coming back on, man. This is going to be fantastic.
Oh, thanks, guys. I am so thrilled you want to talk about my labor of love, Rites of Passage. Thank you so much. It needs the love, so let's just all hold hands as we talk about it, if we could.
Absolutely. Just. You know, full disclosure, Peter promised us that he'd get us an interview with Harrison Ford, so that's the only reason we're doing this. No, I'm totally kidding. This film is awesome. It's streaming on Netflix right now, so I hope everybody after listening to this runs and goes to watch it because it is actually a very good film.
And
So
I want to also just throw in, I'm not I am by no means a horror sort of thriller, gore guy. And while this movie is a lot more than that, I think it was one of those things where I wasn't expecting to enjoy it as much as I did. And we can talk about the film, the elements, sort of critically what we liked a little bit later, I'm sure. But it's definitely a movie that has more than people gave it credit for being. So I think this will be a lot of fun. So.
well, let me just tease the listeners, which with the fact that when we premiered this film where we shot it in Isla Vista, California. Isla Vista is the actual college town on the beach of UC Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara. So we premiered it there because we shot it there, and the Chumash Indian, the great Chumash Indian Nation. They sent about 10 people into the premiere, and they literally had to all be arrested and taken away. They were so upset with the film, even though they had never seen it because it was the premiere. But just the idea we'd made a film that spoke about the Chumash, the great Chumash Indian Nation, without sitting with their tribal elders, they called us cultural prostitutes. They took all the cars in the parking lot, put flyers that Peter Iliff is a cultural prostitute. I'm not sure what that is. It sounds kind of sexy. And they came in and they rather violently and rudely disrupted the premiere where the projection had to stop and cops had to be called and they had to be taken away. So, and then they mounted a campaign. I mean, this is amazing. My hat's off to them. They mounted a campaign of basically one star ratings on all the Amazon and IMDb, and they went as far as to go and hijack our website and our IMDb page and put their own message of cultural prostitution on it as opposed to what we had put on our own web page and IMDb site. So it just makes me realize I'm glad I never had to fight the Indians back in the day because they are some tough customers. So that's Rites of Passage. And it began because the location in Santa Barbara on the Groen Rose Ranch is owned by my dear friend and co-story, Rick Halsey. The Halsey family has owned this property, which is indeed a Chumash Rose Ranch, a Chumash burial ground. Since the turn of the century. And I met Rick Halsey, who's gone on to be a professor of natural history, and he started the California Chaparral Institute. He's very well known for his California, ecology point of view and his natural history teachings. And having grown up on the site, Rick became an advocate of everything Chumash because the Chumash Nation was slaughtered by the missionaries. To the point where the Chumash no longer even knew their original native language. It had been lost. And so, anyway, I met Ricky and UCSB. We're party buddies, and we'd party on this ranch site. And then as years went by, we'd take our infant children there for weekends. And then they became our teenage children, and, you know, 25 years had passed, and all of a sudden Rick and I were there 4 years ago alone, both writing. And we went for a midnight walk through the great greenhouses. It's a rose ranch. So there's a cottage on a bluff. There's the beach. You go back, there's these old derelict falling apart greenhouses. And we were walking through there at midnight, and we saw the old boilers with my flashlight. And I was so struck by the pure cinema and of this, I said to Rick, "Hey, pal, would you let me shoot a movie here?" He goes, "Yeah, sure. Hey, well, would you put $100,000 into it?" "Yeah, why not?" So I put $100,000 in it. He put $100,000. We had $200,000, and there we started. Didn't even have a screenplay. That was January of 2010. Okay, we had first shot 10 months later, 9 months later, actually in October. So it's an amazing story of how we raised the money. The first thing was, what should we talk about? And at UCSB at that point, the Daily Nexus, the UCSB paper, had written the story that actual weekend we were there together. And on the cover of this paper, I was once the editor-in-chief of the Daily Nexus. And the cover of the Nexus was "The Joys of Anal Sex." I kid you not. Now, as a man who's 11 years sober from drugs and alcohol, believe me, I am no prude. But as a journalist, I thought, what the hell is my former paper putting "The Joys of Anal Sex" as the Wednesday editorial on the cover of the UCSB Daily Nexus? We marched down there, Rick and I. We had a talk with the editor, and it sort of started our thinking about, it's really interesting being a student at the university now. You know, you're in an era where hookup sex has changed your sexuality, where hard drugs are available. In my day, there was weak pot, you know, and cane beer. Now it's, you know, it's some serious hard drugs. The pressure to succeed. And how about the prescription drugs, the Adderall, the Ritalin, and it's just, you know, and like, it's just it's a much different powder keg for these kids than it was for me. So we decided, well, what if we made a movie about these UCSB kids in Isla Vista, where we actually came up, and what if they went away for the quintessential weekend at the cottage, like every great horror film, you know, not every great, but like, you know, that classic motif, and all hell breaks loose. And of course, in our case, they go there in anthropology class and they go to study the Chumash, and they decide they're going to drink the tea that was for the rites of passage ceremony of the Chumash youth, which was Jimson weed, which still grows to this day on that property. And it's a very serious drug. Do not drink Jimson weed, okay? It may cause serious damage to your brain, including blindness. But it's an interesting statement in our society, where there's no longer a rite of passage for young people. We basically get drunk and throw up on our 21st birthday. Am I wrong? Unless we go off to fight a war, there's really no rite of passage ceremony. So there was the movie. So what we did, what I did is I, even before there was a script, I took my little $800 camera I bought at Best Buy, and I shot and edited a 20-minute short that I edit on iMovie on my Mac, and I would take it around to private individuals and show them the movie. This is the movie before the movie, and I raised another $150,000 from private investors, Jerry Shimalis, Douglas Econ, among them. And then I went to producer Mark Canton. Mark Canton used to run Sony, or was it Warner's? He is one of the huge producers. He had just done the 300 and was in post on The Immortal at the time. And I said to him, "Will you help me achieve my dream?" And the guy goes, "Oh, shit." Because how do you refuse an honest request? Will you help me achieve my dream? I want to direct this movie. And I've been working with Mark. And to his credit, he stepped up. And I said, "Mark, I just need you to make a few key calls. And one of them is call CAA and get me Christian Slater. We've been waiting 8 weeks with a $300,000 offer." And finally, I got his private phone number from a friend of a friend. I called him. He took my call. I talked to Christian. He read the script immediately after been sitting on his desk for 8 weeks. Because all these offers are on these guys' desks with checks attached. They have their choice of gigs, right? Then Mark Canton followed with a personal phone call. And by the next morning, we had Christian Slater for $300,000. And by the following week, we had Stephen Dorff that Kent brought in for the same amount of money. Dorff was fresh off that Sophie Coppola film Somewhere. So he was actually at a height of his business at that time. So Mark Kent did that. And then our casting director, Shannon McCannion, brought in Wes Bentley to do a table read. And we fell in love. And, of course, Wes Bentley's career has skyrocketed since we shot this film. He was sort of off the map for a while for some personal reasons, and he was making a comeback. And Wes Bentley is, you know, he's the man. And so all of a sudden we had a film where basically the structure was $1 million to shoot, $1 million to pay the cast, and $500,000 to do post, a $2.5 million film. And that's kind of the formula you have these days for these low-budget films. And as you know, you want to basically shoot it all in one location by using the Rose Ranch for 4+ weeks. We could park the company, use the Rose Ranch as our production office and various offices, you know, build the sets in the actual greenhouses, and basically scout and meticulously plan out the shot list for everything else, and then go shoot another week in Isla Vista. And that's how we did that movie. Now, let me stop for a second. Do you have any questions you want to throw up before I ramble on?
Yeah, I would love to know, just because we are in a very different era of filmmaking, especially independent filmmaking, where there's so many options out there, so many movies get made. And part of the reason is that you've got these independent financiers and guys who, you know, one guy puts up a little bit of money here and one guy puts up a little bit of money there. And before you know it, you have your financing for a movie. What is that like? What is the process like of doing that? And do you suggest that people, you know, sort of try to into that?
So, in this case, Voltage, who had made The Hurt Locker, was the foreign sales outfit. And they never invested any, you know, you can sometimes get what we call an MG or a money guarantee, where they will actually front you money. Actually a piece of paper that you take to a bank, and based on projection of foreign sales, that money guarantee can get you some money from a bank. They did not do that. But what they said was, okay, you have Christian Slater. We call that a +1 at the $2 million budget range, meaning he's worth in foreign sales about $1 million. You need another +1 to pair with him to reach, at the time we thought it was a $2 million movie at that time. So we needed another +1, and they have these lists that are rather informal and are simply based on the foreign sales agents going to the marketplace like AFM and Berlin and Toronto and selling, and this is what they feel stars are worth. There's no actual printout or website where you can get these numbers. It's basically your conversations with the foreign sales agents. They deemed Dorff as a +1, so once we got Dorff, we had a $2 million budget. And we could have then gotten an MG from Voltage, but then Bill Johnson of what's his company? I'm having a – it's a Marist. Bill Johnson stepped in, Johnson financed the rest of it.
Bill Johnson as in Lotus Entertainment?
No, this is the Bill Johnson of the Marist. There are two Bill Johnsons.
Okay.
This is the newer one on the scene. And his company did that great Philip Seymour Hoffman film, A Most Wanted Man, that I think was Philip's last film.
Oh, I love that, yeah.
So his family runs the Franklin Templeton Fund, which is, how many hundreds of billions of dollars, whatever. They're the owners of my favorite baseball team, the San Francisco Giants. So Bill came in because at that point it was a profitable movie deal. I mean, you've got these two stars, you've got a certain guarantee of sales, and now it's basically, yeah, you can have my money on these insane amount of points I'm going to charge for a period of time while you make your movie. It's really about that. Once you have stars guaranteed that cover the budget, it's rather easy to find the rest of the money. The hard part is getting the first star to commit, because let's face it, a guy like Slater, even though he's not a huge movie star anymore, he's still a CAA client with very tough agents, and they are not going to let him do anything that does not feel real. So that's why the ace in the hole for me was I got Mark Kent. Mark Canton is as real as they get in terms of producers. So by getting my knees and saying, Mark, will you help me achieve my dream? And he was very touched by my begging and pleading that now I could actually guarantee him a salary and success and ask him to make that call to CAA and say, yes, I'm involved in this and you can trust what Peter's saying and the money's in the bank account. And the agents who handled Dorff and Slater believed Canton, so they allowed the deal to happen. So if you're, a newcomer to the business and trying to get one of these guys, the problem is their representation will not let you have them because they don't trust you. They don't know you. You have to get that 500-pound gorilla producer on your payroll, so to speak, on your team. And that was the difference for us. So I owe Mark Canton all the thanks in the world. He never once stepped on the set of the movie, but he was very involved in the post-production and the edit. What else?
That's very cool, because this is like indie filmmaking 101.
Yeah, it was for me too, because I'm a writer in the studio system, so I had to learn all this, but I've been around people doing it, and I'm around it now, people who are just, trying to make offers to actors, but like, I'm telling you, their representation is not going to let you have them unless they have a comfort level, So
right.
That's that. So what I wanted to do, I've made a lot of serious films, and I write a lot of serious films. But I actually wanted to go out there. I wanted to make a popcorn, teenage, darkly comic horror thriller. And I think my biggest mistake might have been, I was never really quite sure what my tone was as a first-time director. I think if I had chosen one genre, it might have been a lot easier. I might have been more successful. But I tried something that was a fusion, because I always loved fusion movies. My favorite movie was always Alien, because it was a fusion of the haunted house, and a monster in a haunted house, and then outer space. To me, Point Break was a fusion. It was, a surfer movie combined with a bank robbery. I've always loved these darkly comic, the Sam Raimi horror films, The Evil Dead, and so on. And of course, the Coen brothers, who are the masters, when they do it with Fargo and whatnot, you get kind of that quirky side combined with genuine, thrills and, very dark stuff. So I did not go for an art house film. I went for something I thought would make a lot of money. Because I got to pay the rent, boys. And so I was always fascinated by getting thrills and chills on film. I mean, when I was a little boy, I'd be in a theater and I'd see, the light projected on the theater screen and all the kind of dust coming up through it, and how by us looking at that image projected on a screen would when I'd watch James Bond in his Aston Martin, in Goldfinger trying to get away, oh my God, I was so thrilled. So I wanted to see if on a low budget I could make a real badass thriller. And what I wanted to design was, at some point in this film, and it happens in Rites of Passage, once they drink the Jimson Weed tea, it is nothing but chaos and confusion. You'll notice the camera look, it all goes to handheld, and it's all constantly moving now. And it's nonstop chaos and kinetic action for three reels. A reel is like 18 minutes. And that to me was really an interesting thing to do, because if you have to build a story where if you're following enough characters, you're following group A and they've got their problem. And then once that problem is sort of for the moment solved, you now cut to group B and they've got another problem. And then you're out to group C, and then you're back to group A, but then group A splinters off to two more groups, and you can keep cutting to the next dilemma that is very kinetic and frightening, and hopefully you're getting this build of like, holy cow. And that's what I was most proud of. And then I was most proud of some of the guerrilla filmmaking that came with the film. Like, there is a scene where Kate Mabry is driving the wrong way down the 101 freeway. As filmmakers out there, the audience, how much do you think that would cost to run a car the wrong way on the 101 freeway? If you're a big movie, that's a couple $100,000 to shut down the freeway. Well, we did it for $500 because we had to go back after the film was wrapped And I got a permit to shoot at the Lompoc Airport on the taxiway at night. We got 10 friends to come up for free. We used their own cars to park on the freeway. I bought them all Subway sandwiches, and we got a guy on a motorcycle, various camera rigs. And if you notice, Kate Mabry's car for most of it is actually not even moving. The car is stopped, and the other 10 crewmen are in their cars flashing their lights, driving very slowly past. Or we'd have her car stopped, and we're actually shaking the car hood of her car as cars in front of it are driving by slowly, flashing the lights again. And we're doing it 90 degree shutter like you saw in Saving Private Ryan. Or we're doing it over crank or under crank, so it's slow-mo, it's fast. We created a look, and then you get a great editor and sound design. That going down the wrong way in the freeway looks as good as anybody else could have done it. And that to me was like, oh my God.
I would love to jump in. Yeah, I want to jump in real quick because we were talking about the look of the film, and it certainly looks a lot more, you know, you're telling us it's a $2.5 million movie. It looks a lot more expensive than that, and it does have a very nice visual look. Pronounce the guy's last name for me. His name is Alex, the DP, because he's
Alex Nepomniachtchi, who did that great chase scene in the opening of NARC. Alex Nepomniachtchi
is a great DP.
How
did you find him? Did you go after him because you that opening had stuck it out in your head as being so visceral and raw?
Exactly why I saw, you know, a NARC, the Joe Carnahan film, when that chase, you know, he's basically handheld chasing a guy down an alley, up over a wall, and it's just crazy. So I went specifically after that DP because I wanted his knowledge, because in Rites of Passage about the 30-minute mark is something else I wanted to do. I always wanted to do a chase. And there is a chase where Wes Bentley chases, you know, Brianna Evigan in a yellow bikini and all this Chumash tribal markings. So she's just escaped from this little lair where Wes is kept. Pardon me, as I refer. She's escaped, and it's a chase through this greenhouse. And it is a tour de force of me learning about all the ins and outs of action chase filmmaking, you know, all the different shots. And then to get an actress who will put on a pair of sneakers or actually barefoot and run through that warehouse, this greenhouse is, 50 times? You know, with motorcycles following her, with, you know, sidecars, with, you know, I mean, every kind of a way to shoot it, because basically you need to assemble as much footage as you can from every possible angle to make it as kinetic as possible. So we're really proud of that chase. And the early cuts was like 5 minutes, and then they made us cut it down to about 2.5, because you're constantly told in the edit room that, you know, less can be more in terms of impact.
How you set up this genre fusion film like you were discussing earlier, and those are the films that you like, as you referenced Alien, and I have to say that's what makes this film excel to the degree that it does, because it's darkly funny. I laughed out loud a couple times while watching it. Christian Slater and the weird little stuffed animal thing was great. For people, we're not going to spoil anything here, but Christian Slater's this just deranged, insane person, and he's awesome in it, obviously, because it's Christian Slater. But he has this little stuffed animal hanging from his shotgun that he talks to that's, like, in his mind. It's amazing.
It's the imaginary sock monkey. So what we had to do is actually get the shotgun and get a real sock monkey, and you have to shoot it where he's talking to his gun and there's no monkey, because it's in his mind. Then you shoot the same thing with the monkey on it, and then in visual effects, you can very easily create the eyes blinking and the mouth talking on the monkey. So we had a monkey with no face, and we could animate the face. So you're shooting it with him talking to the gun from all angles, like, you know, over the shoulder of Christian Slater, OTS Slater, OTS gun on Slater, with monkey, without monkey, and it became you know, when you get a good editor to play with this, it's freaking hilarious. And the monkey was named Delgado. And we even got tapes before, you know, because Slater takes his craft seriously. He was like, he would send us tapes of him riffing with Delgado. And he actually came to live in the greenhouse, which was his little home, for about 2 days before we started shooting. He wanted to get so immersed in the character that he was freaking living there, talking to the sock monkey. And I've got the sock monkey right here, right now. I love little Delgado.
So Christian little. Slater's that hardcore of a method actor?
Yeah, he is. And I think also the fact that it was you know, a Rose Ranch on the beach in Santa Barbara didn't help. Didn't hurt, rather. So, right. Like, hey, I'll hang out there for a while. No problem, guys.
Right. So you have that aspect with Christian Slater, who's freaky in the film, for those who haven't seen it. I mean, legitimately freaky. That opening scene, the opening of the film's awesome. That just, like, instantly grabbed me, and I was like, whoa.
Well, that was the his, that was his idea. It was like he had the skull cap. He wanted the scene from Star Wars where Darth Vader's head when he removes the
right.
helmet. So he referenced that directly, and that was Christian Slater adding that idea. So that's an actor doing
that's
something
good.
Pretty cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. So you have that element, and then it's sexy. Because you got a bunch of attractive actresses to be in the film, which is awesome.
Well, Stephen Dorff's first scene is basically he has got Ashley Hinshaw, who's one of the most beautiful young blondes we've ever seen. She's in a tight black cocktail dress. And his first shot is to basically be on top of her with his face between her breasts and then between her legs. That's his first shot of the shoot. He was a happy man.
Awesome. I'm sure. And Ashley was just in this season of True Detective for those who watched it. She's the actress that...
Yes, that puts Taylor Kitsch all the hard time. That's Ashley Hinshaw.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's creepy with Christian Slater, funny with Christian Slater, sexy and steamy with Old Girl from True Detective and Stephen Dorff. And then... it builds to this insane action in the third act. It becomes like this action thriller.
And another thing that's funny about it is we shot it on Isla Vista in the exact same bowling. We used to call these apartments on the water bowling alleys because they were a deck and then a hallway that had five rooms straight back. They were the bowling alleys on Del Playa and Isla Vista. We shot at the exact same place where I lived when I went there years ago. We actually knocked on the door. The students there are a bunch of engineers / stoners because they're going to UCSB. And they were thrilled. And they're the actual students. You see them in the shot when it opens in the morning and they're all laying on couches wiped out from the night before party. That's the actual four student engineers who live there. And it was hilarious to go back and relive my own past and the party sequence, which is a 14-minute sequence, is hilarious. When Squirrel is, like, slamming the cookie pan on her big boyfriend who plays Moose, by, you know, Daniel Cudmore plays Moose. It's hilarious. And then all there was a bong we made called the Bong of the Gods that literally had two chambers, and you needed to get a shop vac, literally a shop vac, to start drawing the marijuana through the eight chambers of this Bong of the Gods. And of course, we found that the fake marijuana didn't burn right and it wouldn't go through the eight chambers. So of course it had to be real marijuana. And here I am, you know, like, you know, sober. And there's this incredible, you know, they're burning the blueberry marijuana for the scene. I'm like, oh God. And my actors are getting a bit stoned. And, you know, and of course the scene where Kate Maberly has to get on the table and dance in that tiny little dress. She was very nervous about it, and she had to play someone who was drunk. So, unfortunately, we had to get her drunk. And so she played the scene so drunk that she actually had to throw up in the very same bathroom that you see her early as an actress on camera throwing up in the film. I mean, like you know, fiction became reality just because she was so nervous to do the dancing scene. So, you know, funny stuff.
Yeah, this definitely sounds like a fun time. Sounds like my kind of set. My question is, outside of the guys that you needed to get in order to get your financing, when you go to cast young actors and actresses for the roles for the students and everything, what was the process like doing that? How did you come about your choices?
Well, you know, you really do need to get a top rate casting person. So Shannon McCannion was our gal, and she's wonderful. And she's, you know, she just has a relationship with so many young actors. And so, example, you know, Ryan Donahue, who plays Nathan, who's kind of the kind of frail looking star, he's a great actor. I mean, I think that guy's going to go on and win an Oscar someday. He's also got a great band called Animal Talk. He's a great singer and a musician. But anyway, so she brought us him. And then Travis Van Winkle, who's now on The Last Ship, he did that thing that in auditions that you want to see from someone who's going to play a man of action, because he's kind of the strong guy, Travis. He was the kind of guy that would make his voice go down and softer when things got tough. You'll find lesser actors will raise their voice and try to be ferocious. But you'll notice our superstars, our Brad Pitts, our George Clooney's, whatnot, they actually lower their voice because there's more menace in a kind of restrained voice. And when Travis did that, I knew he was the kind of actor I wanted, and he's just so sexy on screen. And just to see him go on with The Last Ship kind of proved that we actually got someone cool. I think it's so much fun in these movies when there's an ensemble cast to watch their careers. I had that opportunity in Varsity Blues to see Paul Walker become the big star he was, to see, you know, Ollie Larder become a star, Scotty Kahn, and of course Vanderbeek was already a TV star. So it's fun to see these guys. I mean, Wes Bentley was a has-been for that movie. He had been in American Beauty, and he'd been kind of away from, you know, and away from movies for a while from some personal issues. And to see him now being, you know, Interstellar and all these Chris Nolan films and now on all this stuff. You know, Kate Mabley is a fine actress. You know, Brianna Evigan was on one of those, you know, Take It to the Streets movies. And, you know, her father was a great kind of TV classic actor. And anyway, the list goes on. You know, Guy Burnett, Daniel Cudmore, Angelique Zabrana, Sharon Hinnendale. I mean, what a cast of young people. I just love them all. And you become a family. The greatest thing about directing, I think, is, you know, you really build a family and that you hope to take on the future films, you know. And here I am, you know, shooting on my next film, King Me. We start shooting on December 7th, and I'm bringing back a lot of the crew, you know, so it's really nice.
So you're about to direct your next feature?
It's a short film, sorry to say. It's a 22-page script. But I'm about to direct my next film, King Me, and it's being produced again by David Hopwood, who runs Mark Cannon's company. And my AD is Scotty Metcalf, like in this film, and a bunch of other characters are showing up. And it's a film about the homeless in Los Angeles, and it's such a great story. It's this It's a Venice beach bum homeless guy who finds it so violent that he wants to go to Thousand Oaks, which is like this, you know, peaceful community where you raise your children. But of course, the cops grab him and they dump him on Skid Row, which is, there's thousands of people in downtown LA Skid Row right now. And a journalist sees this and says, why don't you wear a body camera and go right back to Thousand Oaks and have the cops pick you up again and let's get it on tape. And it becomes tragic and ironic, and it becomes a question of who's the villain, the reporter, the cops, or is it people like me who live in the Pacific Palisades in these rich communities in L.A. and are not doing anything about the homeless that we don't want by our Starbucks? What are guys like me doing to solve the problem? I think I'm the villain. So that's the film I'm making. You know. So
that's awesome. Is this something that you could or want to turn into a feature?
Absolutely. It's essentially would be the 20 minutes, the beginning of a feature. So that's, you know, a lot of films have done this, like Sling Blade. You know, they got Billy Bob for 20 minutes, and then I believe, what was that great drummer movie we've seen this past year? Is that
Whiplash?
Whiplash.
Yeah.
Same thing. So we're trying to do the Whiplash model of making the short first to go off and raise the rest of the money. And, of course, Rites of Passage kind of put me in film jail because it didn't make any money. So I got to bust out of film jail. And nothing like doing a short. And this time, I really am trying to make an art house piece, a provocative piece of filmmaking that gets people to talk. And so I'm taking a different tact this time, a more adult tact. But I'll tell you what, I sure love making Rites of Passage. It was a lot of fun.
Now, do you, when you got a chance to direct your first feature, and you did it, and you know you've been so successful in the past as a screenwriter, do you see yourself wanting to continuously direct stuff, or is writing still your number one, you know, passion?
I'll be honest. I think directing is the best job in the world. I've been very personally disappointed that Rites of Passage put me in a position where people didn't want to give me another chance to direct. So it's really lovely that you guys are showing some love to the film. You know, I think guys like me have had the opportunity to work for great directors. I mean, I've worked with Jim Cameron, Kathleen Bigelow, Philip Noyce, Mark Campbell, just the list goes, Guillermo del Toro, the list goes on. And you learn a few things from these guys and these women that you work for. And after a while, you realize directing is simply having a vision that you can articulate. And even though I'm not a camera guy, I don't come from the technical side, you know, I can articulate a vision, and I can get people who, you know, the technical guys are like, okay, I get the vision, so let them do what they do, and let's work in concert. I don't pretend to be able to do everybody's job. I'm not that director. I'm not the Jim Cameron. But I can articulate a vision. That's why I tell people, if you can articulate, you can be a director too. And I find that way the various departments are rooting for you to win, as opposed to thinking you're an arrogant son of a bitch who you hope that you might want to see fail. You know, by letting these professionals do their job and hopefully getting these conversations about what is the vision and everybody contributing to that vision, that is the secret. And then, of course, the great joy would be, like you see Ridley Scott's been doing it so well for 30-plus years, he brings back a lot of the same people every time. And, you know, he's basically responsible for them being able to pay for their homes and send their kids to college. And it's like a one giant extended family. And to me, that's a beautiful thing. It really is. I would like to have that for the rest of my career if the gods were willing. You know? And I think to be able to write the script and then to direct it too is a great plus. But I'll tell you this, after having edited the film, you realize, you know, in an editor room, you might bring on another editor just to take another look at things. I think in the future, I will not be so stingy about writing the script myself. I think I'd like to maybe generate the script or polish it, but I think it's wrong for a writer-director not to want to bring in other writers to challenge you and make the best script possible, because that's how it is on the set, and that's how it is in the edit room. And so why shouldn't it be for the screenplay process as well? You know?
Yeah, that sounds great. And I mean, essentially, you've had a ton of prep your whole career to become like a writer director, essentially, right?
Well, yeah, that's, you can compensate for experience with preparation. So if you're a first time director, you just prepare an extra month or two because you've got to make up for that lack of experience. You can't just show up and know where to put a camera. You got to think about it a long time.
And just in general for Rites of Passage, because you had set out to create something that sort of straddled different tones. Where did the genesis of the idea come from? I mean, how did you arrive at all these different pieces?
We were talking about earlier that the actual property that Rick owns, his family's owned since the turn of the century, is indeed a Chumash burial ground. So we had grown up, and he had taught me all about the Chumash, and we both have the highest respect for the great Chumash nation that was wiped out by the California Spanish missionaries to the point where their language was lost. And So that was an interesting thing about this property. It was organic to the property. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the university had an article in the paper about the joys of anal sex. And I thought, what kind of chaos is happening in the lives of these students that this is the UCSB paper? And so for me to do a clash of these two things, you know, what it's like to be a student, and then to have these students examining Chumash, you know, and then to have them take the ultimate party drug, which would be Jimson weed. And again, please do not drink Jimson weed. It is a very, very dangerous, hardcore hallucinogenic. But I'm a guy that, you know, I used to have a drug problem. I mean, I've been sober 11 years now. I want to make a drug movie. I thought it was kind of interesting. I want to make a full-on drug movie. And here we go. So these elements came together to form Rites of Passage, all based on the location, the Chumash, and the nearby university.
And how long was the actual, like, script writing process? Like, that probably was more my question, was just that, like, it seems like you had these great ideas and you were, like, not, like, putting it together the day before you shot it, but it feels like a very organic, fluid, creative process.
Well, you know, like I said, we had the idea to make a movie in January. Then I made a little 20-minute handheld movie I cut on my, you know, iMovie software in the Mac. And then I thought, oops, I better go and write a screenplay. And so, you know, I can bang out a first draft about 6 weeks. But then, you know, from the moment you write a first draft, you're constantly rewriting. And you're getting notes from Mark Canton and David Hopwood and the whole gang. And then things are changing because, you know, production dictates you can't do this. And I also found something that I never realized before, that I tend to write long, meaning that, you know, there's usually an axiom of a page of script is worth a minute of screen time. But I was kind of finding that, you know, my 100-page script was actually almost like a 3-hour movie. And you're realizing when you say the camera moves from, you know, a pan from this part of the Rose Ranch to that part, that might take an eighth of a page to write, but it takes a minute to film. So it was a real education to me and how I need to start writing scripts that are more time accurate, that the things I'm writing are actually representing the page per minute philosophy of, you know, writing a script to time length. That was an interesting process. We had a lot of scenes that had to come out of the film, and that dictated a lot of my rejuggling of scene structure in the edit room. And like they say, the edit room is another screenplay. And it is interesting to boil down your original idea now in the edit room to just a bunch of shots. And if you've ever edited a film, at some point in your mind, you can see every shot, and you can drive home from the edit room, and you can see the movie playing in your mind as you're driving home. That's how familiar you get with it. And you'll find that you're bringing a different editor. Glenn Garland was our editor. And then a little later, we brought in George Folti, who had directed Animal House. And also, I mean, sorry, it edited Animal House and Coming to America, and it also edited Eli Roth's 3 Hostel movies. What a weird combination of mentality is that. But George Folti is like a USC professor of editing, and Glenn Garland, you know, he does all Rob Zombie's films. I mean, Glenn Garland is a fabulous editor. So if you look at the editing of Rites of Passage, you had, frankly, two masters of the craft putting this movie together, and I'm particularly proud of the editing. So when I talk to somebody who understands filmmaking, they go, holy cow, that was one edited mofo of a film. And also I'm very proud of course, the cinematography. I mean, Alex Nibamishi is a master as well. And, you know, we was the first generation of red cameras we used, and everybody's sort of struggling to figure out how they worked. And, you know, they're all, at that point, they were still coming from film, and, you know, like Nipamishi wouldn't think a certain shot would work because we've had enough light. But of course, in post now, you can do so much to make the worst of shots actually be any kind of light you want. I mean, you can take in the DI, the digital correction process, you can take the sky and literally select it with a pencil and turn it any color blue you want to. So if you're shooting on an overcast day, you can make it look like Hawaii if you want to. And at that time, a lot of the DPs didn't understand this process. And of course, my first time through post, as a writer, you're basically asked to come for 20 minutes, then you're asked to leave. And when you're a first time director, it's like, oh my God, I'm supposed to be here 14 hours. I'm used to people telling me to leave. And it's a constant learning process. And another thing that was interesting, all those visual effects in the movie, I mean, we had no money. That was done by a college student on the cheap. Because the biggest story of Rites of Passage is the most interesting is that we finished our $1 million shoot, and the line producer, John Saker, put the checkbook into a storage locker, and he left the state of California for New Jersey to never come back. And 2 weeks later, all the checks to our cast started to bounce. And we realized that John Saker had essentially, you know, gone over budget without telling us. And, you know, I'm the director. I'm worried about, can I get this done in less than 5 shots? I'm not really the guy sitting in the, you know, production office with the checkbook, right? You know, I'm like just trying to make sure I'm making my days. So he, to keep the movie going, he lied to us about the money. Then he put the checkbook away. He left the state, and all of the checks to our family, the actors, all the tech people were bouncing, and all the money for post-production was gone. We had no more money to post-produce the film. And after we, you know, got over our anger and our sadness, basically, I had to raise another $500,000 to finish the film. So, you know, that was quite an ordeal. A lot of the investors were screaming at me. And, of course, since you're the director, it's your fault. But, I mean, if you know anything about directing, I mean, you're on the set trying to make your day. And as long as you're not doing anything crazy, like, I have to have this crane or I have to have 20 takes. It wasn't like that. So we were all fooled, and I took a lot of heat from a lot of people on what they were calling my irresponsibility. And that was hard to take. And then, but because of that, we had to really learn, well, what's the least expensive way to post the movie? And a lot of friends like Chris Dobbs at Stampede, who is a trailer house, Chris came in and basically held our hands and told us what we have to do, who we have to hire, where we can get our better bang for the buck. And it was really a great experience in post-production. And any director will tell you that the dessert of filmmaking is post, because to sit in an edit room with smart people and really cool gadgetry and play with your film for 3-4 months is a blast. I hope you all get the opportunity to do it sometime. It's a lot of fun. You know, what else can I talk about for you? Okay, you haven't lived until the line producer has put your checkbook in the storage locker and left the state. Check
later.
I can only imagine what that would do to any movie, but I mean, let alone one that's a low budget and independent effort to begin with, and everyone's, you know, cooperation and best interest, you're supposedly looking out for everybody. So that clearly sounds like a royal, you know, kick in the nuts. And I'm glad you persevere through it.
You know, what is interesting in filmmaking is you have to have an attitude of, okay, let's get into solution. We had a line, we called it delete and move on. Whenever something was a pain in the ass or someone was, you know, something was really bad, you just delete that email and you move on into solution. So it became this kind of way of living, like, okay, I can't, the anger I'm feeling is not going to help me solve this problem. You know, how do I solve it? And again, to Bill Johnson, who came through with a lot of the post money, and to Rick Halsey himself, the co-writer, one of the producers, who went into his own pocket so the crew members could have money for their Thanksgiving holiday, because the film wrapped right before Thanksgiving, so the checks were bouncing as the holiday season was hitting. So here's your crew who you're going to spend 6 weeks worth, or in some cases 3-4 months with, and then you're now your family. Like, the money isn't there? Like, oh, God. So, you get through it, and they did get paid. Everybody got paid. So that's the good news. Everybody got paid.
I wanted to ask you about the score.
Except me. Yeah. You direct a film for $1. The DGA will let you direct a film for $1. So I directed Rites of Passage for $1, and I invested $100,000 of my own money into it.
Hey, everybody. The Blu-ray and DVD is on Amazon.com. Go out and buy it.
Let's get
Peter some money back here. But it is. I mean, I looked it up. The Blu-ray is $10. Seriously.
Is it really?
The Blu-ray is $10. The DVD is $8. And if you're cheap, you could watch on Netflix. But, yeah. No, but I did want to ask you about the score of the film. I can't pronounce the person's name. I don't want to butcher it.
Ilya Cimerov.
There we go.
Who is a prodigy from Czechoslovakia, and he actually did the score of Ronin.
Right.
Yeah.
I actually just watched it the other day.
Yeah. He's a great composer. He's a genius. He's the kindest man.
How did he just run with it, or did you have an idea of what you wanted it to sound like?
Yes, you know, it's a very interesting conversation, these things. I am a hack guitar player. I've got a band called Naughty Pete and the Buzzkillers. I'm Naughty Pete. I got like 12 guitars on the wall hanging behind me. So I know how to play garage rock, although I can't sing to save my life. But I know a bit about music, but to talk movie scoring, you just have to kind of like reference other films, and you have to reference tones. And I think what we were talking a lot was we love the score to Apocalypto, the Mel Gibson film. And the Apocalypto soundtrack has a lot of, you know, indigenous native musicians. And so we talked about that idea at length with Ilya, and he ran with it. And then he gave me that little electronic lick, like the theme song of Rites of Passage. There's this roar. There's this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I mean, I can't even. I haven't heard it for a while, so I can't. I'm not doing it justice. But it's a total composed series of three or four electronic chords that are like augmented dissonance, you know, fifths and sevenths, and it's just awesomeness. And we decided to take that in the music edit and kind of re-loop that as a signature sound. And, you know, whenever things got gnarly, you would hear that signature four chords played. And Ilya would do things like when Christian Slater is talking to the sock monkey, there's a little kind of circus music playing. And this was Ilya's idea. If he's talking to the monkey, and he's missing his dead child that was killed, and the sock monkey is a representation of the dead child's sock monkey puppet, then you hear this kind of childlike music. But Ilya scored it where the notes were wrong. Like, you know, you expect a certain musical phrase to end and resolve a certain way, but he would have the musical phrase resolve in an unexpected and frankly wrong way. And so when you listen, when you see the sock monkey, you hear this wrong music being played, and it's things like that that I've never even heard of, that he explained these techniques that great composers have been using for years to suggest, you know, mental insanity. And so another idea, like if you have a vision, you explain your vision, and then you leave it to a great professional genius like Ilya Cimerov to give you, you know, to flesh out these concepts. And he's a great one. He's got a little studio in the valley that he makes his magic. And God bless him.
Yeah, it sounds like you definitely had a very solid crew working with you on your first movie. And I would imagine that, like, you know, like you said, you probably want to work with these people again and create the family atmosphere. So
absolutely. You know, you find that I was blessed because I've been in the business for a while. And people, you know, if you ask somebody honestly for their help and they see you're sincere, people really do respond from that. And I would say that anything in life you do, there are four principles of success. And I used to write this down. The first principle is to have a burning desire. The second principle is to have a plan. And the plan has to be cold from the masters who went before you. So one, burning desire, two, a plan, and three, you have to eliminate all negativity. Anybody who says you cannot do it, you simply cannot hang with any longer. You don't even want to hear what they say. And the fourth, you have to align yourselves with like-minded people who share your dream. And these four principles of success can be applied to any endeavor that we in life want to go after. Want to burn desire, a plan called for the masters, eliminate all negativity, and four, align yourself with like-minded people who share your dream. And that's exactly how I put Rites of Passage together. And people, when you're sincere about this, people respond. You know, we want to be a part of someone going after their dream because you know they're sincere and they'll give it their best shot. And filmmaking is all about passion, isn't it? I mean, these are people who are cutting their price. They weren't making their full price. They were cutting their price if they're not working for free, like guys like myself, you know? So that's what Rites of Passage is to me. It's a lot of top industry professionals from Mark Canton on down cutting their price to help me do a dream project. And I sure wish we hadn't pissed off the Chumash Nation, who we have nothing but respect for, who did come and basically, you know, have to riot our premiere and get arrested. But, you know, it makes for a funny story, and that's life.
Yeah, sounds like they had a lot of too much free time on their hands. I mean, honestly, if people were to pull that kind of routine over, you know, half of the movies that might potentially ruffle feathers because of some, you know, ill-advised reading into the material, I we'd probably have picketing outside of every movie. So it seems a little insane that went down. And another unfortunate aspect to you trying to get this movie made, which honestly, again, I mean, it's a creative, unique, fun movie. And a movie like this has a lot more going for it than some of the really slick, you know, crap that comes out from the studios. You know, there's actual genuine thought. And, you know, one of the things that I've always responded to with material like this, you know, when I am going to watch it is, you know, how funny is it and how interesting is it and how, you know, how much is the filmmaker able to juggle tone and do something different? So you certainly succeeded on that front.
Well, again, if I haven't said it enough, you know, my dear friend Rick Halsey, whose family is on the ranch, you know, who has shares co-story, we came together. You know, it was really fun for two lifelong friends, one who isn't even in the business, to have the opportunity to play with this. And like I said, you know, he had grown up loving the Chumash. He was raised, and in his house were actually ceremonial bowls. The actual bowl that Benny uses is an actual Chumash bowl that was dug up on that very property. And so it really was this labor of love, and it was just nice to bring friends together and try to have some fun and make a good movie. So, you know, we're sure proud of it. And thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about Rites of Passage.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, man. Thank you so very much for coming back on. You've been super gracious and kind to us to speak about everything in your career. To reiterate again, so everybody knows, Rites of Passage is on Netflix to stream. You can buy the Blu-ray or DVD on Amazon. You can also rent it on Amazon and Vudu. And when your next film comes out, King Me, you're more than welcome to come back to talk about that as well.
Yeah, that sounds like
something.
We would love to see that.
Definitely.
And the other good news I can share with you is Paramount Television and the country music television, CMT, have opened negotiations with me to create the series Varsity Blues. So I'm thrilled to be getting into television in a serious way.
Well, that'll be fun, and that'll open up that.
That's cool.
That's a classic audience favorite right there, and it'll certainly open up that world to a new audience as well. So that'll be a lot of fun. Congratulations. That's very sweet.
Yeah, the mocks is coming back, boys and girls.
Very good. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure talking to you. It's honestly a blast. So, you know, we'll be keeping in touch, as you, I'm sure you're well aware, and we'll have you back on down the road.
Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it so much. All right. We'll talk soon, guys.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Bye-bye.